We made this.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Time Is Now, a podcast all about the TV series Millennium. Soylent Green is people. I'm your host, Tony Black, and this is a special episode as we sort of wind down our coverage of Millennium and The Time Is Now after we've, you know, completed the final episode of the series. Goodbye to all that. But we've still got a few extra little things to come before Kurt and I return for a sort of wrap-up finish episode. And in this episode, we're going to dip our toe into what I guess we could call the world of fan fiction. Although, as we might talk about in this episode, I feel like that almost does what we're going to talk about, a slight injustice, because we're going to talk about the virtual seasons, the two virtual seasons of Millennium that followed the end of the show, the fan-written continuations of the series. And I'm really chuffed to be joined for this discussion by the co-writer of virtual season 4 of Millennium, Dan Owen. Dan, welcome to the show. It's really great to talk to you about this.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's quite serendipitous, Dan, that we're talking about this, because when we first started The Time Is Now, I thought, you know, I'd really like to talk to the guys who sort of instigated this whole thing. So you, Dan, Kevin Patterson, Matt Essendorf, you know, back in like 1999 when this came out. And I was like, I don't know if they've ever popped up online. I don't know if they've ever been anywhere online. So I put it in the back of my mind. And then you and I started following each other on Twitter, as people randomly do. When I saw, oh, that guy's a writer, he's good, I'll follow him, and that kind of thing. And then it eventually sort of clicked together that you were the Dan. You were the Dan Owen who did Millennium. And I was like, oh, wow, we already follow each other. And that's when I asked you to come on. So how strange and millenniumistic is that, Dan? Like, you know, that's the cosmos working there.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange part of my online history, running the virtual season. So not many people ever mention it or put two and two together. Yeah, so I was quite surprised that you knew about it, to be honest.
Well, yeah, and it was just a moment where I went, oh, wow, okay, right, well, you know, we've got to do an episode on this then. So we'll come to all this, but first, normally what we do when we get a new guest on is we do what we call the 5 group initiation questions, where we talk about your Millennium fandom and get a little bit of your insight. So, we'll start with this. So, I mean, this is going to go way back to the 90s, I guess, but when did you first discover Millennium, Dan?
I was immediately a fan, really, back in 96. I was a big fan of The X-Files, obviously like a lot of people were at that time. And it was obviously the next thing that Chris Carter was doing. So I kind of knew about it right at the very start in various magazines. It was talking about Millennium and what it was. It sounded interesting, sounded a lot darker and different. There was no aliens or anything. It was all going to be a more realistic thing. And I don't know, it just caught my attention, obviously. I was interested in it. And I liked the first season. It was definitely quite a grim season. And I can see why it didn't catch on with a lot of people, like The X-Files did, really. But there was something in it. And I always liked Lance Henriksen as well, from Terminator, Aliens, all the films that he's known for, really. Pumpkinhead. So I was interested in him in particular. And he kind of kept me with it, really, through the episodes that was a bit grueling. With the subject matter and things. But it was around the time, wasn't it, of Science of Lambs and Seven and all those kind of things. So it was kind of in the air that it was like of interest to people. And within the Millennium coming up itself, I mean, I remember those days, and there was a little bit of anxiety, wasn't there? A bit of interest in that, strangely. And so I was just kind of immediately interested in the show, and I watched it, and I enjoyed it enough to continue watching. But for me, it was really the second season that I kind of became a big fan, because that was just more to my taste, really, the second season. So that was like in 97, I think, 97, 98 season. That's when I kind of started the website. I was that interested, and the internet back then was a very new thing. So even building a website was a new adventure sort of thing online. And I had Netscape Navigator. I remember those days. And so I created a website, and which is a bit of a hobby, really, just trying to get that to work. And it was all FTP uploads, and it's really old days, wasn't it, doing that? So I created a website, and it was called Millennium 2000, and it's not online anymore. And I don't think it's even on the Wayback Machine, because I have looked in the past. It's gone, I think. It's just vanished. Yeah. So I don't even know what I did on that website, strangely, because I don't know. I can't remember writing reviews every week or anything. I must have done, but I can't really remember exactly what I did even on the website, strangely. But it was there anyway. But there was a lot of websites similar to mine, and we took the lead from the official site, because you didn't really have much of an option in those days. You didn't really know much more beyond what the official site gave you in terms of news and things. So you kind of just kind of based your website off theirs and tried to inject a bit more personality into it. So I think I must have done episode reviews, I'm sure. But anyway, that was it. So I was a big fan, and that website was one of maybe six or so that were popular. So Matt Assendorf ran a website, and he ran the Millennium Compendium. And when the show came to an end, he kind of came to me with the idea of doing the virtual season.
We'll get more into that, definitely, because it's interesting how, yeah, you started off the back of that kind of, you know, interest back then. As you've said offline, at a good age, I think you and I are about the same age, to be fair, because I was around 16, 17 when Millennium sort of came out.
Same here, yeah.
Well, actually, I think I'm slightly younger, because that was more like when it finished. I think it was when VS4 came out, that was around the age I was. But I was old enough that I remember it being on. I remember watching it at the time. Although I think the pilot was rated 18, so I don't know if I should have been.
Those were the
days where, like, I was a 12-year-old renting out things like Crimson Tide and Diary of a Vengeance from the video shop. Like, you know, the whole like certificate thing didn't stop us. It was an interesting time to be a Millennium fan. So it was a good time, really. Obviously, because it was on the television. But what was your favourite episode then?
Yeah, it's difficult to say, really, what an absolute favourite was. I have a few. I think one that always sticks out in my head, I don't know if this is always mentioned, maybe not, but the Mikado for me. Is that still popular?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it had lost any of its power, because obviously the internet's quite a standard thing now, but that storyline involving a serial killer on the internet was just kind of like quite a fresh sounding thing back then. And obviously, being online myself and with a website, it just seemed like, oh, right, this is like perfect subject matter, really. It kind of combined a lot of things that I was doing offline as well. So that was probably one that stands out. I remember that being a particularly good episode. And that was in season two, wasn't it, as well? I'm right in thinking, yeah, yeah.
That's right.
So it was kind of like a bit of a throwback to season one. So I quite liked that as well. I liked the idea. It was kind of like a season one episode, being a very serial killer, grim episode. But I don't know, it had a bit more flavour of the second season as well in there. And just the whole idea of the internet being involved just kind of gave it an extra interest for me. So that kind of stands out. But also, most of my favourites are in the second season, to be honest. I'm quite a second season fan. Everything comes from that season for me, really. So Curse of Frank Black was a good one. I liked that. Mainly because I think it was one of the first episodes, although I'm sure the X-Files did a few, but it was kind of like almost like a gimmick episode in a way, wasn't it? Because there was no dialogue, or very little dialogue.
Very little.
So I remember thinking, that was quite a strange, different idea to do an episode like that. And obviously you get kind of experimental episodes like that quite often nowadays. But back then, there wasn't too many TV shows doing things like that. You know, Twin Peaks, maybe, and I'm sure the X-Files had done a few strange things by 97. So that was an interesting one. I remember being quite gripped by that one, and just the whole tone of it as well being quite strange, and it was set on Halloween, just kind of perfect for the show, really. So yeah, I'm rattling off quite a few now, so if you want one favourite, it's so difficult. But and the Owls and Roosters two-parter, I'm sure that's still a fan favourite one from season two. That's probably a defining episode in the sense of what the virtual season lifted from and was inspired by, because I just liked that whole mythology and how it really deepened the show and took it in a brand new kind of direction and really put the stamp on that season as being very different to the first season. So that was a very influential one. And just a two-parter of that season as well, again, for reasons of just how different it was. There's no other TV show doing that kind of thing. It's very apocalyptic and strange and quite trippy, very visual. And I don't think I remember any TV shows doing anything like that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I just don't think there was anything being that strange. Not many things. Twin Peaks, as I've said, definitely. But for network kind of mainstream TV, there was very few shows like that.
Yeah, I think definitely all the Lara Mean stuff in The Time Is Now, that long protracted sort of Patti Smith sort of madness sequence is very, very... Even now, that stands out as something quite unique.
Yeah.
And I mean, you and I think have very similar tastes, because two of your favourites are in two of my favourites as well. The Curse of Frank Black, which is genuinely my favourite episode of television ever in any show. I absolutely adore that, and I watch it every year on Halloween. I agree about Owls and Roosters. I think there's some fantastic stuff in there. I particularly love the Wagner sequence at the end, where it's all like a montage as they destroy Odessa and stuff like that. So it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So yeah, great choices, absolutely great choices, and everyone, that's the beauty of this. Everyone's choice is different with Millennium, which is really good.
Yeah,
I think we've kind of answered the next one. Favorite season.
season two. Yeah, I mean, that's where it all came together for me, you know. And it's just down to taste, isn't it? I know some people, even at the time, said that season one was better. It was more serious and it was more what they wanted, and that's fine. And I did enjoy season one. But yeah, it was quite heavy going that season. So I liked what they did with season two. It just gave it just more interest. There's more variety to the stories. And obviously Glenn Morgan, James Wong. And they pretty much created the X-Files in a strange way, didn't they? Because Chris Carter may have started it, and he did create it, obviously. But they kind of invented a lot of the things that you think of when you think of the X-Files, in terms of like... secondary characters and things, and a lot of the ideas apparently came from them. So they were very influential with that show. And they kind of came in for season two with Millennium and did a similar thing. I thought they kind of took what was there, they realised what worked, what didn't, and they kind of spliced elements of what the X-Files was doing, I suppose, with cults and things like that, that it's touched on. And they just had a different take on the same kind of material, and I just liked that blend that they brought to it. It wasn't dismissive of the first season, but it kind of just took it into a new direction, and it made it more interesting, more accessible. I think obviously it wasn't too much more accessible because it still wasn't a big hit, but I think by then it was just the problem was that season one, I mean, shows that back then, they lasted like all year round, didn't they? So you had like a full year of this type of show, and everyone had just kind of made their mind up that it wasn't for them. So even though season two was a marked improvement, it was just very difficult, I think, even in those days, getting people back into something. I think nowadays it would be a lot easier. You'd get a lot more chatter online and things, and people would notice it and they'd tune in, and or they'd be able to go into Netflix or something, if it was a Netflix show, and just specifically watch certain episodes to kind of take their interest. But back in then, in those days, it was, if you hadn't recorded it on tape, and why would you? If you didn't like the show, you wouldn't really have a way to go back to it, so you just miss it and it would just slip you by. And I think it was scheduled badly, wasn't it? Was it Fridays, which was a bad day for in America?
I think the graveyard slot.
So it had a lot going against it. It's just really unfair, really. And so I was surprised it got a third season, based on what had happened in the first two, with the ratings and things. But anyway, season two, just for me, that was just the best season. It was firing on all cylinders for me, and what I enjoyed.
Yeah. Completely agree. It's my favourite as well, for all those reasons. So absolutely. Favourite character then? Who would you say?
Well, I hate to sound like a Philistine, but it's got to be Frank Black, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's fair enough. He stands out, doesn't he?
I'd like to pick a different choice, a more unusual choice, but no, it has to be Frank Black. I can't really deny that.
Yeah,
I mean, he's the lead the lead actor, lead character. So yeah, I mean, I love Lance Henriksen. Everything that he did with that character, I thought was great. Yeah, I mean, I just like that kind of character that he was. Somebody who was a family man and goes to work every day and just faces the kind of worst horrors of the world and has to kind of compartmentalize that with his home life. And obviously in season two, it got even stranger and stranger for him, and he kind of got sucked down a different kind of hole. And I just like that kind of character in general, which obviously is inspired by a lot of other characters and real people as well, isn't it? Who was the guy who wrote the famous FBI book?
Oh, was it Robert Nilsson or someone like that? I think his name was. I know what you mean.
It was kind of inspired by him, wasn't it? He wrote a famous book. Oh, God. I can't remember his name. Yeah. But it really annoy me now. But so he wrote that book, and I think Frank Black was kind of based on him. So just those kind of characters in real life or fictional ones. I mean, Manhunter, obviously, with Will Graham. I'm sure there's a bit of crossover with his character as well. So Frank Black for me. I mean, Peter Watts as well was a popular character. So there's definitely a second choice for me. Peter Watts, Terry O'Quinn, who obviously went on to Lost, another show that I loved. And he was just as good, if not better, in that. So, probably Frank Black or Peter Watts.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, again, completely agree. Terry O'Quinn's my favourite team. Well, actually, he's now my favourite actor since Sean Connery has passed away. My favourite living actor. Mm. Sean Connery has always been my favourite actor, but he's still in many ways is for many reasons. But yeah, Terry O'Quinn was always my favourite TV actor, and I just love every. I'll watch him in anything. He's amazing. So yeah, definitely, completely agree. All right, and finally, what would you say your favourite moment overall from the series is? This is obviously a difficult question to ask, but we always get some interesting answers.
Well, I haven't seen the show for a long, long time, so if I did a rewatch, I'm sure I would pick something different, and I probably pick something more character based to look more intelligent. this is a good choice because it's obviously lingered with me for so long that I still remember it. But the season two finale with Lara in her cabin and her kind of visions that she was having there. For me that was quite a daring, memorable thing. And it went on for a long time, didn't it? Was it the whole act of the show, wasn't it? It was just that.
Yeah, it was like 10 minutes or so.
Yeah. So if you just flicked on to that and the channels, you'd just get this 10 minutes of bizarreness happening. So it's quite a bold thing to do. So I remember that being like quite an amazing thing to watch. And so that's always kind of stuck with me. So when I think about the show, I tend to think about more the visual things. You know, I'm just that kind of person, really. That's the kind of things that stick out to me. A lot of the visuals and things of the show, it lingers most for me. So that was probably a highlight of those.
Yeah, I think it's, like I said earlier, I think it's really stuck in the mindset of people, that one. I would love to have been there with someone who's flicking channels and goes, oh, what's this Millennium show? And then they flick onto that, you know, horses, all that stuff. And it's just like, whoa. It's amazing stuff. So yeah, awesome. Okay. Well, I think we've got a really good picture there of your fandom going back there, which is brilliant. So let's dig in a little bit more and talk about the virtual seasons. So obviously the term virtual season is something that is... I'll give you a bit of backstory and context here. I know this term a little bit better. Well, firstly, I instigated the virtual season 5, which we'll talk about later. And it was partly on the back of virtual season 4, which was your show, but also that I'd been involved for several years with a website, which is still going. It's called MZPTV. And that whole site was based around script-based fiction. And it was based around script-based fan fiction and some original stuff as well. But quite heavily, we did spin-offs of things like Alias. We did spin-offs of things like Buffy, particularly. Buffy and Angel, which there was a whole Buffyverse on that website and things like this. There was all kinds of stuff on there. And there's a whole trove, actually, for people to go and look at, which includes Millennium Virtual Season 5. And we used to use the term virtual season to sort of denote the idea. And it was fan fiction, but we denoted it in this way as a way of saying it's online, it's virtual. It's a season of television because we wrote them in the style of a season of television. And that was the way we approached it because we wanted to try and replicate that experience on a fan level. So was this a term that you had in your head when you came to this, you know, or is it something that's just sort of developed over time?
I'd love to take credit for it. It'd be great to say I thought of this term. Are there still virtual seasons now? Is it still a thing? I don't know.
I think it's tailed off a little.
I mean
the website that I was on doesn't really produce content anymore, and I haven't really seen much since social media really kicked in. So sadly not.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Not really.
No, I don't know who came up with it. I mean, it may have been me. It may have been Matt, who I worked with on the season. Or there may have been things that existed before it. I think I distantly remember him saying that things like this had existed before. I think for a few different shows. Things that had ended. I don't know if they were for shows that... Actually, I'm trying to think that. I don't think they were shows that had finished. I think they were just like running concurrently. So it was just like people had... So it was like fan fiction. So yeah, like Xena and things, I think. I think I remember him saying these kind of things existed and they were called virtual seasons. But I don't think they took place after a show had finished and they were like a natural kind of continuation. I think we were maybe the first to do that. I think. Maybe I'm wrong. But I remember thinking it was a different kind of a thing. That's what part of the excitement was. It wasn't fan fiction, which still has bad connotations to it, doesn't it? Even back then, I think the term still was like, oh, it's like fans and their own fiction and they're going to make different characters sleep with each other and it's just going to be craziness will happen. It'll be entirely driven by what fans like and they don't like the right kind of things and this kind of bit of snobbery there as well. So we wanted to do something that was legit, you know, so it was like a virtual season and that kind of meant to us that it was almost like you could stumble upon it online and think, oh, the virtual season. Maybe the people who made the show have done a virtual season. Maybe they've been axed from the airwaves, but they've all gone online and they've made this season. We could kind of trick people into thinking it was like genuine. Maybe that was part of the thinking. But it was just a different term that kind of stuck for some reason or other. It was just better than saying like a fake season, wasn't it? So that's like the alternatives that you could say to make it sound worse. Like fan fiction. Fake season, it doesn't sound good. So virtual season just made it sound like, oh, maybe this is like a genuine thing. So I think that's what it was. In terms of it being like script format, I don't know if we came up with that. Maybe it had existed before, but that was just partly driven by the fact it would be easier to do, because otherwise you'd have to basically write novels or novellas. That was what fan fiction commonly was, wasn't it? It was kind of written prose. And we just didn't have enough time for that. So scripts are easier to write in that sense, the format. So and also it would just sell the fact it was like a virtual season. It was like we could kind of maybe convince people that these were like unproduced scripts from the show that had been put online sneakily. And it was like the virtual season that never existed sort of thing, but here it is online. So that's what it was. I mean, we weren't kind of hiding the fact it was made by fans, but yeah, that was the thinking. You could kind of go into it and think, okay, I'm going to buy into it and give it a chance and read it and think, imagine this was like a real show and these are the scripts, and can we trick people into thinking, yeah, this is good enough to be acceptable, and I can see this being a fourth season, and I think we were successful. I believe. Obviously, we're now 20 years later talking about it, so there must have been some interest.
Well, no, absolutely. It was one of the first virtual season sort of continuations I remember, and it was certainly the one that really stood out to me as being, wow, these guys really know their stuff, and I think it was. It's interesting because the whole idea of reading scripts for fun, I don't think it's a very, very niche idea. It's a very, very niche idea. There is tons of fiction out there that, like you say, is prose-based, that people don't think twice about going to Archive of Their Own or fanfiction.net, some of which is good, you know, absolutely, some of which is terrible, you know, some of which is just all about sex, basically. So there's different strands of it. Most of it doesn't interest me at all. But that is the more accepted sort of, you know, way of doing things. But actual scripts, I don't think it's ever really become part of the consciousness in many ways. And we were tinkering away on it in our little corner for years, and I think we produced some fantastic stuff as a website. But I feel like VS4 was a real marker moment for this. And it's a shame, actually, that it didn't spawn a much, much bigger sort of movement, actually, online for this, because it was genuinely professionally great. And I'm not just saying that because you're on the podcast, Dan. I've really thought that for... I don't think I read it quite at the time, because I wasn't really on the internet till around the mid-noughties, but it was very much around that time I read it. So it was a few years after Millennium had ended, and it really stood out to me as being extremely good. And as good as anything, I think, would have been written for the show. So, yeah, I think it's very interesting that it represents one of the best, I genuinely think one of the best examples of this whole very, very unusual way of approaching fan fiction, if you like. And like I said at the start, I don't really think it deserves that term, which is why I prefer Virtual Season, because, and it's not out of a snobbery, it really isn't out of a snobbery, it's more out of the fact that I think there's a clear distinction between the two, myself.
Yeah, I mean, just, yeah, fan fiction to me is an interesting thing for fans to do and to explore their own imaginations, and it's definitely has value. But I think, yeah, we were trying to genuinely continue the show, because it was just such a crazy thing to think that a show called Millennium would not reach the millennium. It just seemed like madness, you know. And back in those days, you didn't really have fan campaigns to get things back on the air. I don't think that had really taken off like it would do. So we weren't sending things to Fox. Like you know, people used to send, didn't they? What was that show where the people sent food or something to the network, and it had some relevance to the show? I can't remember.
I know what you're talking about.
Was
but
it
I can't remember.
Veronica Mars or something? Was it?
I don't. Could have been something like that. Something like Pushing Daisies. Was it Pushing Daisies?
Pushing Daisies.
So there was all these or something.
Yeah, loads of pies turned up. Yeah. So that kind of thing came later, really, where there was real fan campaigns online. So in those days, it was just like you just had to accept that that had happened. But it was just you never occurred to you that you could do anything to change that. So all we just thought was, okay, well, surely we can't just let that lie. And in a sense that the story has to continue somehow, because it's the year 2000 is coming up in 6 months. Something's got to happen with Millennium, hasn't it? So that's what kind of triggered the idea, and obviously the Virtual Season came from that. And yeah, so it was fan fiction, but with more of a kind of goal and an aim and an intention behind it. And it just had to, it just had to be different than fan fiction. It wasn't going to be like just a random standalone adventures with Frank Black, written in a novel form, which you could do. And maybe people have done since, but this was actually like, okay, we'll just do our own season. It was that kind of attitude. And we only had like 4 or 5 months to do it. So it was quite a huge undertaking, yeah.
Yeah, massively. Well, that gets us onto this then. So that you've given a little bit of the origin. So you talked about the Millennium 2000 website and that getting on, you know, together. So how did this all come about? How did the decision to make this season come about? How did you get involved with Matt and then the other writers on the show and structure it and things like that? So tell us a little bit about that, the beginnings of all this and how it all started to come together.
Yeah, well, this is where my memory is very, very, very blurry.
Yeah, I'm asking you to go back, what is it now, 23 years?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very difficult to say for sure. But
okay.
I may be wrong in this, but I think what happened is that Matt Assendorf, who was the co-creator of VS4 with me, he was the one who kind of, I think, instigated the whole idea, and he got me involved initially. And so we kind of had the idea, and we knew that our timescale was very tight, and we had to recruit other people to help us. So he ran the Millennium Compendium website, and I think he used that to kind of try and recruit other people to the cause. So that's where all the other writers come in, like Kevin Patterson and many others. I'm trying to find their names now, give them a bit of a shout out. So there's Andrew Wyatt, Gavin Hunter, Anne Andrews, Marcus Dixon, yeah, Andrew Denst, lots and lots of people, David Klein, Eric Davis. There's lots of people online, Bunny Williams, give them all a shout. So yeah, so all these people, Jason Walsh, another one. So all these people kind of responded to us, and they said they were interested in continuing Millennium in some form. A lot of them came from, I think, fan fiction backgrounds. I don't think many of them had much of an interest in script writing as such, which caused us some issues, because obviously some of them had to be adapted into script format, because it didn't always come to us in a proper manner. So it'd arrive and it would be like a bit of a hodgepodge of a novel with bits of dialogue, and it was obvious they didn't really know the format so much, so we had to kind of like adapt things and make it look as uniform as we could. But that is why I think this is true, that if you look at the VS4, there are many episodes where it's a bit looser with the scripting format, I think. That's my memory of it anyway, is that some of them read a bit more, they were a bit more thick with the text, which is not really what you want in a script so much. But although to be fair to them, we did say that it was a bit of a hybrid, because the idea was to, we were loose with the script format. We thought, okay, we don't have visuals, and these won't be made into TV shows, like a script is a blueprint for that. So we were kind of a bit lenient. We said, okay, you can kind of, you can describe things a bit more than you would in a normal script to kind of get the point across a bit better, because these aren't going to be made into anything. So, there was a little bit of flexibility there, but there was definitely some differences in people's approach. And it was just very difficult back in those days as well to kind of do this kind of a project, because you didn't have Twitter or Zoom or anything like that. I mean, I don't think you could even speak to people on Skype back then. I don't think that existed.
No, I don't think so, no.
So it was all very much emails back and forth. I think the Millennium Compendium had a forum, and I think Matt set up a special area where people could talk there. So yeah, so you're going back to the days of news groups, aren't you, and things, and it was all very much text-based, back and forth, that kind of thing. So it was very difficult to do this in general back then. But yes, that was the idea. So we kind of recruited all these people. We all pitched their different ideas. We were quite happy for them to have more standalone ideas, and we just kind of we'd handle the kind of core mythology, if you like, and the real spine of the show. So the arc of the season would mainly be in our episodes, the ones that I wrote. So yeah, so and that was the idea. But then they could seed a few things. I think we had a few new characters and a few new ideas and things. Obviously, the setup for the season was different. So their episodes had to kind of reference those changes that we'd made. But most of their episodes from the other writers were kind of more standalone from memory. Which is good, you know, and that's how things were done in those days, wasn't it? It wasn't really that serialized. You just had the X-Files format of having standalone episodes with a kind of thread going through it of the mythology stuff. So we kind of copied that trend. Yeah, so that was the idea. So and everyone went away. Everyone wrote their episodes, came back with them, and we put them online once a week.
Did you go through like a process of as a writer's room and a showrunner would, in that did you or Matt touch any of the scripts up? Did you do any revisions to them? Did you go through any process like that? And what software did you use, actually? I mean, this might be something that won't be as interesting to anyone else than somebody who's written like a few hundred scripts in his time years ago. But yeah, what was your process there in terms of running this group of writers in that way?
I don't think there was too much involvement in a way. We were kind of at the mercy of them in a strange way. We couldn't rewrite them too drastically. We just didn't have the time.
Well, the reason I ask this though, Dan, is that because they all seem, when you read them, they seem like they are of a piece. It doesn't feel like you've got, you know, you talk about how some of them are maybe a little bit more detailed in some of the description and things like that, but generally it seems to fit the same sort of style and piece of the season. So you never feel like you're getting a script that is completely out there and doesn't jar and jars. You know, it feels like it's been curated in that sense. So that's why I ask in that way.
Yeah. See, I may be, again, not remembering certain things that happened, I think. So possibly Matt was going in and adapting things and doing that kind of side of stuff. Because he was definitely more in charge of the team, in a sense. So maybe he was more responsible for that. And to be honest, I think I wrote the majority of the episodes. So I was mainly fixed on that. I think my kind of role was like doing that, and I had so much more to write that I had to focus on that. So I think Matt was maybe doing more of the kind of housekeeping stuff and rewriting things to make it seem like other piece. So maybe that's what happened there. So sorry, I can't be, you know, it's very difficult to remember exactly how we did it.
Don't worry.
But yeah, in terms of software, I mean, nobody had a Final Draft or any professional screenwriting software back in those days. I think I had Movie Maker. I think it was
Movie Magic.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. I think I had that. So I was using that. But I don't know what everyone else used. We didn't really dictate to them what they had to use. I believe most people used Word, Microsoft Word, and just sent it to us. Obviously, everything uploaded was just a straight text file, because back in those days, that was the best thing to put online for text that everyone can read to the same standard. I don't think PDFs existed, I don't think. So, yeah, it's just really early days, isn't it, of the internet. So it was all kind of text files in the end, but yeah, it was nothing special, the software we used. It was just, I think it was Word or even just Notepad, you know, just straight tapping away in there in Courier font, you know, very, very basic. Yeah, nothing special. So, but yeah, and that's it. That's my memory of it. We did have a guy who created the print ads. I remember if you look at the virtual season, there's little print ads there. We had a guy doing some graphics in that sense, so he would create these tiny little thumbnailed images and things, which is I quite like those. When I go back to the virtual season, I have a look down at all the little graphics and think, oh yeah, it gives it a little bit of flavour.
Well, so yeah. It's funny because again though, this is where I think some of what I did on that website grew out of, because we used to do graphic icons that were very similar per episode, and we'd have someone Photoshop and put the episode title on and things like this. And these are based on, as you say, the print ads that went out, you know, on Fox and all this kind of thing. And they are really good. They are. And all of this can be found still at the Millennial Abyss, which is fourthhorsemanpress.com. And it's all there. All the episodes are there. And it's lovely. It's presented, actually, in a lovely way still. And it's a wonderful mainstay, actually. Something like this is a reassuring mainstay, Dan, in the world we live in. Because it hasn't changed. It hasn't changed for decades now. And when you go on the... when you look at the episodes, they are written in text format and they're paginated to the left of the screen. They're not in PDFs or anything, and they all look really good. It's very easy to read. It flows, but it's old fashioned, but it's very pleasantly old fashioned, and it's all there, and you can really get into the stories. So, and then the print ads are right next to them, as are the reviews, which are all in text as well. So, it's great that all of this is still very accessible and very easy to read. And because that isn't always the case 20 years on with a lot of this stuff, you know. So it's like an archive of its own, essentially. This, it's great. It's really good that it's all there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm amazed it's still there. Yeah. I mean, just in researching this conversation, I sort of went back and had a read again of some episodes, and just I was just glad it was still all there. I did actually download everything myself to my own computer, just to be sure it's not going to go missing at any point. Because I've got no idea who runs that website still. I know Brian Dixon was the guy who ran the Millennial Abyss.
I think it is still Brian. I think it's still Brian. Brian Dixon who does it, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. I remember being very jealous of him because he got a shout out, didn't he, in the season 2 finale. I remember that happening. I was a bit jealous of that. I was like, God, you know, how did he get a shout out? Was he, you know? But he did have one of the best websites. So he must still be around with that online. So he must still be paying for it. Mm. I'm sure he has to host this. So it's good.
Yeah, he's still around. I think we follow each other on Twitter. So he's still going, which is great. So yeah, he's an absolute legend in terms of Millennium and keeping all this on there. So it's fantastic that that's still there. assuming he's still the one doing it, but I think he is. I mean, let's briefly, before we carry on, let's talk a little bit about what you and screenwriting then. Was this something that, I mean, obviously you were quite young. I mean, well, that's what also staggers me, Dan, how young you were when you put this together and how well it's written, you know, for somebody who's like 17 years old. And I don't mean to be disparaging to teenagers, because I work with teenagers every day, and some of them are frighteningly clever and intelligent. But, you know, Millennium was never an easy, you know, throw it on kind of show. It's complicated, it's lyrical, it's mythical, you know, and you really wrote some fantastic stuff at a very young age. So was it always something that you loved to do? Do you still do it? Do you still write? You know, what's the backstory there for you?
Yeah, well, I was actually 20 when I did that.
You were 20, sorry.
20,
okay.
Yeah.
Still young.
So I was a little bit, still young, yeah. But I was 20. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, to be honest, reading it now, because I have gone back and had a quick read through some of the episodes, I'm surprised, to be honest, for my age. And to be honest, a lot of it I can't remember. So it's like reading something fresh and new to me, but I can tell it's me who's done it, because there's certain things I think that's what, yeah, I'd have done that. I'd have added that in. That's the kind of visual I'd have imagined. So definitely I can tell it's me, but it is strange reading it, because I'm like, oh, I didn't know I'd done that, or that I'd found a way to link something from season one into season two, and you know, we're kind of developing the mythology and bringing it to a conclusion by the end. So I was quite surprised about how I managed to do that, and it is quite surprising, especially the time scale involved. Like I say, because we didn't have long to do any of this, and I don't think I've ever been as prolific in any kind of writing as I was in that year. I don't know what happened, maybe it was just youth or something, but I could never do that now. There'd be no way I could crank out that many episodes of television scripts in 4 or 5 months like I did there. So it was just pure kind of, I think it helps to have a deadline, actually. I think that's what was driving it. It was just like, we had to do this by the year 2000, December 99. That was like the clear goal. And obviously the real show would have ended in summer 2000, wouldn't it? The real season.
I think it came out 1999, actually. I think it ended, because then you had...
No, I mean the real season, if it had been made.
Oh, you mean if it had season four? Yeah. So, it would have been. Yeah,
the real season
been,
four, would have ended in the middle of 2000.
That's right.
So we were thinking, I remember that being a discussion point, that we thought, well, okay, virtual season four, you know, if we went with what the real season would be, you know, you'd have the millennium would happen in the middle, and then you'd come back and continue the story for another 6 months. So that's what would happen, wouldn't it? But for some reason, and it seems madness now, really, but we decided, no. The season finale has got to be the millennium happening. So even though that meant we had to do 22 or whatever episodes it was in half the time. So we kind of put an additional burden on ourselves in that sense. So I don't know why we really did that, but it did make sense that, you know, you really want the climax of that show to be in the millennium, surely. I don't know what we would have done to continue past that point. And obviously, I'm aware that the virtual season 5 came along, courtesy of yourself. So you obviously did find a way and a story to continue. But for us, we were thinking, oh, it's got to end on New Year's Eve, you know. So that was driving it. So I think that was the kind of light, the fire that was lit under me to try and get this done. I don't really know. Yeah, looking back on it, I think it's just like, you know, you sometimes you're such a fan of something that you kind of invest so much of your own time and energy into something, and you kind of come up with your own little theories, fan theories, and you read a lot of things. And I think all of that was basically poured out of me in that 4 or 5 months, because obviously I was a big fan of the show. I was a big fan of X-Files as well. And in between watching the episodes, I mean, I had an interest in that kind of thing. I would obviously go to the library and things and get books on strange things, aliens and all that kind of stuff. Especially being a teenager, you know, and it's just something that you did, or I did, quite nerdy in that sense. So it was just kind of, there was a lot of things knocking around my head that the show hadn't touched on, but I kind of knew about these kind of theories or these kind of things. And I thought, oh, I bet Millennium could, like, involve that or this kind of idea, and had all these different things in my head. And so, yeah, the virtual scene was just like a great way of pouring that out onto the page. And I can only imagine, looking back, that that's what happened, really. It was just a bit of a deadline, definitely a big part of it, and having a clear deadline. And just, the kind of fan, in me, kind of just wanting to put everything that I knew about the show and about the occult and things, just put it all into these kind of scripts. And so I think that's what the secret was.
Yeah, I had a similar experience when I did a spin-off of Alias, which a few years later, which was a show I was obsessed with at the time, like in the early 2000s. I had a very similar experience where I just poured it into like 100 scripts. I didn't write all of them, but like we did 5 seasons of a spin-off show and all the Arcanum and all the lore built up around that. It was a wonderful time. It was absolutely brilliant. But when I go back and read them now, it feels like, wow, some of this, where did this come from? You know, and it's nice in a way to do that.
It's a strange thing, isn't it, when you look back sometimes. Definitely, I'm like a lot older now, and reading them again, I can definitely see where there's some immaturity. And there's some kind of aspects of it where I think, maybe I shouldn't have done that, or what was that idea about? And I mean, they are written by fans. I'm not a professional writer now, and I wasn't then. And definitely you wouldn't quite write episodes as we did. We were always had a rule about the budget. That was actually something that we thought about. We didn't want to go too crazy in terms of what you could put on the page. We had to sort of be make it realistic that this could be made by Fox. But there are definitely episodes where we kind of push that to the limit. And looking back now, I kind of have more of an awareness of what is possible on TV, and definitely in the 90s. So I do think a few of the episodes maybe stretch it a little bit more than I even thought back then. Yeah. But I think that's fair enough. You know, it's obviously, we didn't go too crazy, but we had a bit of fun. But there are definitely areas in rereading some of the episodes, I think, I'm kind of my own worst critic. So with 20 years hindsight, it's very easy to go in and kind of pick fault with things. So I'm glad that you enjoy it, and it's great to hear. And I'm definitely amazed it still stands up. And there's definitely a lot of great ideas in there that surprised me even rereading it. But there's definitely areas where I'm perfectly willing to hold my hand up and say, yeah, that was a bit silly, or that was a bit daft. And the focus on characters sometimes was quite wobbly. I was definitely driven more by plot and ideas more than character. So there's definitely areas where now I'd think if I had a chance to rewrite it, I'd do things differently. Yeah, but I'm sure that's the same with everyone, really. Even professional writers looking back on their work.
Almost certainly. Yeah, I think so. What did you want to say about the show, I suppose? I mean, this is a nice leap-off point for that, because you're talking about some of the stories and about, you know, the really sort of, I think, great thing about trying to be aware of the budget and try and make sure that it's true to the show when you read it, which I think is another reason why it stands up, because you do get a little bit of a sense of that. You do get the sense of the place and the characters, and that it is conceivably, it's not suddenly, you know, Frank fighting Odessa on the moon, you know. it's got that flavor. So what kind of stories and did you want to tell, and what did you want to achieve, really, with this conclusion, I guess, to Millennium, you know, at the end of this this decade?
Yeah, I guess that's a tricky question, because you're asking me to think back to my thought process in 99.
Well, you talked about some of it already, which is good. So, you know, some of it's already come out. But, yeah, were there anything specific, detail, you know, that you can remember?
There was a broad plan. I remember, we obviously knew that Frank had to be kind of on the run, in a sense, at the start, and that he'd go to see his family and stay with his family. And we knew it would be about Frank being a single parent now and having to bring up his child, and his child would be getting a bit older, and we had the idea that she'd start to develop similar abilities to him, and maybe more powerful abilities, and that kind of thing. So we had that as a kind of thread to put through the show. And we didn't. One thing we didn't do: we didn't get rid of characters from season 3 as well, which I think maybe took people by surprise, because you may have expected us to do that, because season 3 wasn't very well received by fans. But we didn't like how season 3 seemed to dump a lot of stuff from season 2. So we didn't want to make the same mistake. So we actually accepted season 3 a lot more than maybe people expected. So we still kept characters from season 3 and wanted to continue their story a little bit. So I remember the idea being that you'd have like three characters in a sense. You'd have like a Frank on his journey, and he's towards the end of his journey with the Millennium Group and things, and he's kind of aware of what they are a bit more. And you'd have Emma from season 3, and she'd be more in the stage of what he was in season 2, being brought into the Millennium Group. And then we also had our own invention, our own character, Ryan Frost, who was kind of designed to be kind of like a younger echo of maybe what Frank might have been. Had things gone a little bit differently for him in his life? But again, my memory is quite hazy, so it's very difficult to think what our overall plan was sort of like. We were kind of just driven by passion and things, and just kind of wanting to see the exciting stories and stuff. But there was a loose plan to kind of keep some threads going. But it was more driven by the mythology and where we wanted things to end up. We had to have a big kind of almost apocalyptic event at the end, and we chose nuclear weapons because a doomsday virus had already been done in season 2, so we went with nuclear weapons. I'm sorry, I haven't really got much of a better explanation, really. It's very difficult to think what we intended to do back then.
No, it's all right, because it's all there. I mean, that's the thing. It's like it's very clear in the scripts, you know, of like you say, the latent threat of a resurgent sort of nuclear annihilation, and the sort of combination, I think, of season 1 and season 2 and season 3 ideas that sort of all brew together. That's the thing that I get from this, is that it takes all three of those seasons. And you can tell from your scripts that obviously your season 2 interest is key. You know, you've got episodes like The First Prophet, which, you know, feels very season 2, you know, that kind of thing, I think. So, but it's blending all of these things together in a way, and that's why I think it... But I'll be honest, it's my favourite season after season 2 of Millennium, season 4.
Oh, right.
Season 4. It really is, because it sort of puts together a lot of the things that I really liked. You know, some of the esoteric stuff in season 3, which I do appreciate, some of the darker, more interesting ideas of season 1, and all of the mythology of season 2, which is my favourite as well, into one pot. And I think it does that really well. And and that's one of that was definitely what we wanted to try and do with Virtual Season 5, which I'll talk about later. But so I think it does succeed in that sense, you know?
Yeah, that's great to hear. Yeah, I'm very flattered that you think it's the second best season.
Yeah, no, I really do.
Yeah, all right, really, that's great. Yeah, yeah. It was a real labour of love, and you can tell it was written by fans, and but like I say, we wanted to make it feel like a genuine season. So I think we accomplished that, and we had a loose plan to have an arc go through it, but these were mainly seeded in my episodes. So like I say, the other episodes were more standalone, with the odd little thing patching it together. But you can kind of just read the ones that I did to get the general arc. So that's it was kind of designed that way.
Yeah, you know, it does, I think it, like I say, it really works. You talk about fans though, and critical reaction. I mean, there was some good fan reaction to this. There was some a little bit of press. There was people involved in the show who said things about it. Can you remember much about this? Can you remember much about the reception that Virtual Season 4 got at the time?
I don't remember too much at the time. I don't know if the reviews happened weekly as we released things. I think more came about in the years that followed, I think. Although I'm trying to remember, really, because on the actual Virtual Season, there is like a link, isn't there, to reviews. So I don't know. I can't remember if they were like, they must have been. I'm looking at it now, actually, as we're talking. So yeah, I think these were kind of reactions taken from the forums.
Yeah.
And there must have been at the time. I don't remember. I don't remember really reading them at the time. Maybe I was just worried that if people hated it, it would really put me off. You know, when they were receiving an episode one week, I was probably like doing the you know, a lot further down the line in the season. So I wouldn't want them to say, oh, this idea is terrible, and then I'm writing like the follow-up to it at the moment. And I didn't want it to kind of be too swayed from my own path by reactions. So I think I probably avoided a lot of the reactions at the time. And I think more reactions came in on there's definitely a forum, isn't there, that still exists where there's still people commenting about it right up to 2005 or 6 or something. So it still had a bit of an afterlife.
This is who we are forums?
Yeah.
They're still going. They're still going today.
Yeah. And I had a brief look on there as well, just as research for this. And I remember 10 years ago, I definitely went on this forum out of interest, and all of this was brand new to me. So the reactions there from people in 2005 and stuff, it was amazing to see that people still were reading it, and people were saying, "Oh yeah, I genuinely think of this as being the fourth season." And it's like, oh, it's amazing that people hold it in that high regard. So and it's interesting seeing people's reactions and what they liked, what they didn't like, and generally, there's not too many negative reactions, is there? It seems to be that people really did like it.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. Yeah.
So it's great that happened. But yeah, I mean, in terms of like the wider impact, I was actually in contact with two of Millennium's writers back in the day. So Kay Rindle, I think her name is pronounced Kay Rindle, and Erin Mayer, who wrote for season 3 mainly, I think.
Didn't they do Midnight of the Century as well? I think.
Oh yeah, in season two. Yeah, that was right. Yeah,
love that episode.
Yeah. So I think they were on the news groups, I think, and so obviously there's a lot of activity in those days on news groups. So I think for some reason, I can't remember exactly how, but yeah, they got in touch. This is before the virtual season had happened, so it was quite an amazing thing for a young kid back then to have actual writers. talking to them and saying thanks for your website and your reactions and your thoughts and things. It's like, oh right, amazing. Yeah, somebody actually is involved. So they were really nice people, I remember. They actually sent me some scripts as well, so I actually do have an original copy of Owls. And
that's brilliant. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm jealous.
Actual copy. I've still got it somewhere. And they even sent me a copy of their script for Matryoshka, which was a season 3 episode, and they sent me that before it had aired, I remember thinking. So that arrived, and I read it thinking, I don't know what this is, and it was a new script. So yeah, when that episode aired, I was like, oh, this is amazing. I actually had seen the script and read that before this episode.
I feel like that just wouldn't happen now, would it? Like there was no way that, I mean, and even back then, I mean, for you to have that level of contact with a writer of a running show before the days of social media, where you know people are tweeting and all this kind of thing, I mean, that's astonishing, really. Especially that you got sent material that hadn't aired. I mean, that's amazing, genuinely.
Yeah, that was probably quite a risky thing for them to do, wasn't it? Thinking about it now, but
a little bit, yeah.
Because I mean, back in those days, obviously nowadays you have Twitter, and it's nice when somebody famous retweets you or likes a tweet from you or whatever, and you can have a bit of engagement, can't you, nowadays with famous people? But back then it was, unheard of, really. Not that they were like super famous people or anything, but they were writers on the show. And it was amazing to have them send me some stuff, especially because I live in England, and this is obviously International Post for them and stuff. So yeah, they sent me some stuff, and with like an official Millennium compliment slip, I remember, and they'd signed it and stuff. And I was like, oh wow, yeah, it's just actually from the 1013 Productions, you know. So that was amazing. That was actually quite useful as well for the virtual season, because I could use an actual script and follow that format. So back in those days, I had an interest in script writing, obviously, but I didn't have any actual scripts, there wasn't many things online, I don't think, back then. And nowadays you can find things quite easily, can't you? Just do a quick search, and there's loads of official shooting scripts and stuff that you can download and read. But back then there wasn't really. So I remember I had a Deep Space Nine making of book, but I remember that had screenshots of scripts as well. I don't know if you remember that book, but. So between that, I was really sad back then, but I used to literally type out scripts. So I just to kind of like get the flow of how it was written and things, and Yeah, so I would just like type out this kind of screenshot of a Deep Space Nine kind of pilot episode script, just to kind of almost feel like I was doing it in a sense. But there's some kind of muscle memory involved in that. So when you came to do your own script, you kind of had the flow of how things were written and how brief you had to be with the action scenes and how you'd format it in general, obviously. And so having a real Millennium script was really useful as well, because they're written a little bit differently to what I was used to. And how they'd do some directions and things. So I kind of tried to follow that with the virtual seasons. That was quite handy to have an actual script there. So that gave an added sense of legitimacy, I suppose. When people read it, they thought, right, it's like a real script. You know, so that's why it was kind of based on a real one in terms of the format. So that's good.
I really like that method, actually. That's a really nice method of screenwriting, to try and get into the flow of it. Yeah, I think if people write, they should do that. I think that's really good.
Yeah. Well, I hear that about people who are writing novels and things, or when they first start, I've heard somebody say that they got like a Stephen King short story, and they just wrote it out, just copied it out.
Yeah.
And it seems really daft, but there's something to that. You kind of I don't know what it is that happens in your brain, but it wires your brain in a certain way. So when you come to write your own thing, you kind of follow that kind of method in a strange way. I don't know what it is. Maybe you end up copying somebody else's style too much. Maybe that's the downside, maybe, but I don't know. But it was useful to me anyway. I remember thinking that was a useful thing to do. And like you say, there was a lot of reaction, and there was some press reaction as well, which took us by surprise. So Matt was somebody who would often contact me to say, oh, look, there's a reporter and he wants to talk to us about the virtual season. And I was like, what? really? People are that interested? But I think even back then it was such a novelty that fans were doing this. So there was definitely two articles. Probably I think there was only two. So there was like an online one from Salon magazine, which is still online. So that was really amazing. But there was also an actual press kind of physical article in a real magazine, which I remember thinking was amazing. So it was a Details magazine, which we don't have in the UK. So I remember Matt, he actually kindly sent me a copy of that, which I still have to this day, and I've got some screenshots of that, so I don't know if you wanted to look at those sometime.
That's cool.
But that's not online. That's probably the best article as well, because that actually has quotes from Lance Henriksen about the virtual season.
Oh. That needs to go in some sort of Millennium Museum.
Yeah.
I tell you, because that's amazing.
So that needs to go up online somewhere for people to read, maybe. But yeah, so a very old magazine now, still in good nick, and I've got some screenshots to show you. But so that was amazing to read that article and actually have Lance Henriksen himself say he's aware of the virtual season, and Kay Rindle herself, she actually commented as well, because I'm sure the reporter kind of got in touch with them. He obviously had some contacts that we didn't to get Lance Henriksen especially. He was filming the Millennium X-Files crossover at the time.
Right, yeah.
I think he'd been in direct contact more with Matt than me, which is a bit of a shame, really. But I think Matt had actually liaised with him directly in some way, maybe just online. I don't think he spoke to him as such, but he dropped the hint that the X-Files crossover was not going to be a good thing for fans. So he kind of let us know it's not going to answer all your questions. It's just like a silly little thing. So we were quite excited for that crossover, but we were also a bit kind of nervous that he would kind of do things that's going to mean that the virtual season is now not canon, because it doesn't follow on from what that episode does. But luckily that episode was a bit of a silly thing, wasn't it? So it didn't really have any impact on our season, luckily. So in a weird way, we were kind of grateful it wasn't a good ending for the show, in a strange way, because we were trying to do the good ending for the show. But yeah, so he kind of he was supportive. I'm sure, obviously, thinking back now, I'm sure he was thinking, all right, a bunch of fans have done their little thing, I'm sure he just thought of it as being good publicity for the show, and to show that it was still had support from the fan base, and that Fox should maybe bring it back and stuff. I'm sure he never read the virtual season, and that's fine. But
you don't know. You might have done, because he's always been very keen to keep Millennium alive. Even today, he's been involved with the Millennium after the Millennium documentary that came out last year. We know those guys on this podcast, and they've and the Back to Frank Black crew and everything like that, and we've had quite a few of those guys on The Time Is Now. So we've we know he still lobbies for this show to even come back today, you know? So it's possible, Dan. Don't count it out.
Well, yeah, it'd be great to know that he'd read a few, but I definitely would point him towards a few certain episodes. Yeah. That's probably going to be more interesting to him as an actor, maybe.
Are they all subtitled written by Dan Owen?
Just give him my ones. Give him my ones. Yeah. but yeah, so it was quite an amazing thing back then to have that level of interest. And one of the strangest things I remember happening, and again, my memory is quite hazy, but I'm pretty sure that Matt said that we'd even been approached by somebody in Hollywood who was looking for writers for a new show of theirs. And it's really annoying, this memory, because at the time I remember thinking, oh, this can't be true. It's like, no, this is not happening. And I was also thinking that how could it even work anyway? Because I live in England and Hollywood's like 1,000 miles away, and you know, and it's just hundreds of thousands, you know, dozens of miles away. I don't know. So I thought, oh, that can't be true. But Matt was saying, oh no, they seem keen that, you know, we can be part of their team and write this show. So that, I don't know what happened with that. See, looking back, I should have maybe embraced that more and really got more interested in it. But I'm pretty sure the show was Freaky Links. Do you remember that show?
Okay, yeah, I do. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was Freaky Links, which would make sense because that came out in the year 2000 and lasted one season. And Michael R. Perry wrote one of the episodes, at least one, for that show. And he wrote the Mikado for Millennium and a few other things. So he was involved. So it makes weird sense that the team behind that were kind of Millennium fans. And they'd obviously recruited Michael Perry. And then it would make sense, you see, that they would have read the virtual season and they would have thought, oh, these guys have got talent. Maybe we should get them involved and things. So I'm really annoyed now that at the time I just didn't really take it seriously. I was just like kind of, I don't know. It seems, and I was quite young, and I don't know, the whole idea of what that would mean for me as a 20-year-old. I was just like, oh no, just I don't know. So I kind of shoved that away, and I shouldn't have done. Maybe my whole life could be very different if I'd have said yes, get them on the phone to me. I'll have a chat, and I'll fly over to LA, and maybe, but I don't know.
Equally, Dan, though, you could have had a soul-crushing experience where you flew to LA and you realised that it was a horrible industry, and you wrote for a show that lasted a season. So maybe it was a blessing in disguise. But I suppose it sounds too much like a fairy tale, though, doesn't it? It's like that whole thing of, this can't be real. You know, we did this as a fan hobby thing, and you want us to write an actual TV show?
Yeah,
I'd have been the same. I'd have been like, what?
No, yeah, it didn't make sense to me. I don't know. You'd have to speak to Matt, though, about that, if you ever get in touch with him. But, yeah, but the team behind it were the ones who did the Blair Witch Project. So, again, it kind of makes sense that they're a bit kind of like guerrilla filmmaking people, and they were kind of like, they look at things differently. And so it just made sense looking back that maybe they were left of people who are not in the industry, and it was all just like, I don't know. So it makes sense now looking back that probably did happen. But we just didn't. I didn't take it seriously enough to pursue it. So I don't think, obviously, Matt did, because he's not, I don't think he's a Hollywood writer or anything now. So I don't think he did. So we kind of like just let that disappear. I don't know what happened, but
that's a real sliding doors moment
in your life. Yeah, frustrating,
but yeah, it's really good. I mean, it's really cool that there was that attention on it, and I think that's where it also stands out, in that I haven't encountered any other project like this that was a fan project that was trying to evoke scripts and evoke the kind of production that had anything anywhere near the same kind of attention. And it's ironic in a way that it's Millennium, because Millennium is well known for being, especially in this day and age, a really underrated kind of lost great show from that era. And you know, now it's really hard. You know, we talked off air about how it, you know, we've mentioned it on this podcast before about how it's not streaming anywhere. There's never been a Blu-ray release. You know, the only way you can get hold of it is if you buy the old DVD box set release now, which isn't in wide circulation either. So and we can't understand, as fans of the show, why this is the case, you know, because It there's lots of reasons why this, especially in the age we live in now, with how television has developed and how we have shows like Mindhunter become a massive success, Hannibal, all shows that take a real cue from Millennium. And I think the writers would actually go as far as to say, yeah, we watched Millennium back in the day. And even if, you know, so I think it's strange. It's amazing, really, that it had this project had this much attention then, you know, compared to where we are with Millennium now, in a way.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That stands out to me.
Well, yeah, I think people were just surprised by it. You know, fans were surprised by the quality, and even reporters and who had stumbled across it, they were quite kind of surprised by what we were doing and how much effort we were putting into it. I mean, the article that I'll send you from Details Magazine is all about that. It's all about how you may be expecting it to be a silly fan fiction thing, and it's just going to have people doing unnatural things that you'd never have happen on a TV show. But they were, their article was all from that angle, really, that they were quite surprised that fans had come together and done something that seems like a genuine continuation. So it's it's quite amazing. Yeah,
I'll briefly just talk a little bit about the virtual season 5, because I think this is something I'd like to do a bigger podcast on. I'm still trying to get in touch with the guy I wrote it with and put it together with. His name was James Jordan, and he was a guy who was involved. Well, that isn't his actual name. He was a guy who was involved in the MZP stuff with us. And he was on there, and we knew that he played his cards quite close to his chest for understandable reasons. But we knew he was a working TV writer back then. This was like mid-2000s. I'm pretty sure he had a credit on Hollyoaks particularly, and I think he was writing for some other things, or he had things in development. But he had an online persona that was quite low key, that wasn't his real identity, wasn't his real name. And he wanted to just do this kind of thing just for fun, I think, because he was a big fan of The X-Files, he was a big fan of Millennium and these kind of things. And to this day, I still don't know quite who he is. I sometimes wonder, have I seen his name on IMDb for all kinds of shows loads of times, and I've no idea that this is the guy who I wrote Millennium VS5 with in the past. And so one day, it's a genuine life mystery I hope to resolve one day. And I have reached out to him on Twitter to see if he wants to come on this podcast, and hopefully he will, but I don't know how often he's on there. But he and I came together to create VS5, because he too was a big fan of VS4, and I suppose there was a bit of hubris for he and I, because we both were like, we can't top that. Like, that is just great storytelling. We can't top that virtual season. But we felt like we wanted to come back and revisit Frank and see where he was after the Millennium. And I think that was where we came from with it. We were curious, particularly after 9/11 as well, and how America had started to change, and how, you know, things were evolving. We were like, where would Frank sit in a world where the Millennium happened and the world didn't end, you know? And it was really interesting coming back into that space and looking at it. What we both talked about at the beginning is that we wanted to try and create we wanted to inject a bit more of season one into it, strangely, as well as season two, because our premiere two-part of The Begotten is actually a bit of a play on the pilot episode in some ways. It sort of does similar things. It's kind of not a rehash as such, but it kind of goes into some sort of similar areas. But we also wanted to get in there the kind of, you know, mythological storytelling that season two did. My involvement was initial with it. James really carried it on, and there were other writers involved, a bit similar to what you did, I guess, in that sense. There were other people writing scripts. My involvement with it as like a showrunner kind of ended, I think it was around the eighth episode. And what we did was we brought Peter Watts back from the dead, basically.
That's risky.
It was risky. It was a very. It was, if I look back at it, it was a very sort of dirty Dem Watts from EastEnders kind of thing for me. When I look back at it, I was a bit like, oh, this is stretching it a little bit. But it's because I loved Peter and I really liked Terry O'Quinn and I wanted to. So I did some interesting stuff, I think, with him, and we wrote some episodes. But I think I got about halfway in, and then I was busy doing all kinds of other things, and James took it on and really brought it to an interesting conclusion. And I think I genuinely don't think it's as good as VS4. But I think one of the reasons I think it's good, but it operates in a slightly different space in a way. And I think, and like you, I'd have to wrap my brains to really go back, because this was nearly 15 years ago when we did this. It was like 2007-ish. I'd have to go back and wrap my brains as to all the details. But we had us, I guess, more of a working writer's room in a way, because we had the infrastructure of this network writing virtual fiction, and we then got writers who came in from there. And we did it a little bit more like that, I guess. But it was a fun process. It was a fun process. And I think there are episodes of that I am proud of. And I think we tried to tap into that post-millennial zeitgeist of the anxiety of, well, what now? What happens now? What are the threats now? What are the concerns now? You know, so, and there were things, like I wrote one that was about eBay auctions online and how somebody had eBayed someone's head that they'd severed. And there was a serial killer operating on eBay, essentially. Things like that. That were, again, a little bit of an evolution of how the internet was evolving. And, you know, if I know there are people out there with ideas for virtual season 6 now, it's set in the modern day. I've seen some ideas for a virtual season 6 from somebody, actually, that I do need to get back to him on, because there is the possibility that I might be involved in a little way with that, or helping out with some ideas. And it would be fascinating to see how Frank's world would exist in our modern age now with the technology, and where he would sit and what you could do with Millennium. And I kind of think that's why we did it as well, because we wanted to sort of... I think Millennium has one of those... I don't know if you agree with this, Dan, but I think it has one of those concepts that you could put Frank in almost any age and the show would sort of morph around what he does in terms of what it says about where we are in the world. And I'd love to see Frank in an age where, say, there was another a Mikado episode, the Avatar comes back. How would he operate now, like with the world we live in now, with the technology? So it's things like that, you know? So I think that's why we did what we did with that.
It's almost a shame that the programme, the show is called Millennium, really. Because if it was just called Frank Black or something, you could keep it going forever, couldn't you? And just have him as the main thing. With it being called Millennium, for me, in my head anyway, it always causes problems, because you think, well, why am I doing this? Because the millennium has passed. So you could definitely carry on in the sense of, you know, have the character react to the fact that things have that time's passed on and nothing happened, you know, that kind of thing. But it's difficult to keep it going forever, isn't it? It doesn't strike me as a kind of show that can do that. If it was called Millennium, you'd have to call it Frank Black or something, and just kind of separate it from Millennium. Otherwise, you're just too stuck with that mythology in a strange way. I don't know. I don't know. It's a difficult one to approach.
I think the further you get away from 2000, the harder it becomes, in a way, I think, which is probably why I don't really think it will ever come back on television, to be honest, much as I'd love to see that happen, you know. And I know they did a comic series that's sort of linked into the X-Files and things like that, but I don't really think it will ever happen. And I think part of the reason is that we are a little bit far away from, you know, that zeitgeist, from the anxiety that it had at the time. And this is why I don't think either VS5 got nearly the amount of, you know, interest and attention in the same way. I know there are people out there who like Millennium, who on the forums and things, who did like VS5, don't get me wrong. But it didn't have anywhere near the traction VS4 did. And I think it's probably because it was years later. Millennium had finished. It was after the Millennium. Whereas I think yours really sort of captured, A, the frustration that it had been cancelled before its time, which I think most people would agree it did. I think Millennium should have run longer, you know, than 3 seasons. And certainly up to the Millennium, as we've talked about. But yeah, I think it tapped into that anxiety and that thirst for these kind of stories when you wrote them in 1999, which was the sort of peak of that, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, definitely. It's so strange they didn't do like at least a two-parter or something just to finish the story off. Just, you know, these days you could imagine that happening, couldn't you? You can imagine Netflix or somebody saying, okay, yeah, well, like they did for Sense8, didn't they? They did like a special episode. Yeah. Just to finish
and
off the story.
Timeless.
Yeah, but back then you just thought, okay, they made a decision, that's it, move on. There was no thought that they would bring it back for a special episode or something, and I'm sure they probably wouldn't have done back in those days, even with a fan campaign behind it. So yeah, we kind of definitely benefited from the fact that we were writing it because of the passion of wanting to finish the story, and a lot of people wanted to read it for that same reason. So it was kind of useful for us, it's definitely a lot harder for you guys doing it after the year 2000, especially when the show's been off the air for so long. Yeah, we definitely captured, you know, some of the mood. People were wanting Millennium. You know, September came along and there was no new episodes, and it was like, well, this is the virtual season if you want to give that a go. And maybe a few people begrudgingly read the first episode and thought, oh, that wasn't too bad actually, and they stuck with it till December. So it was quite useful for us to use the absence of the show to kind of direct people our way.
Yeah. I think that definitely played into it. So to wrap up then, and this is asking you to go back a little bit, I guess, and have a little look at it and think about what you would say here. But what would you, if somebody hasn't read any VS4, I guess aside from the first episode of the season, which is probably makes sense, what are the choice episodes that you'd really recommend as the ones that really stand out for you from memory as the show at its best, you know, that people could really enjoy?
Let me have a look. Let me have a look at the actual list of episodes. See, it's difficult for me because it's so difficult remembering the episodes that I wrote, let alone other people.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to... I sound like a real egomaniac, but I can only really go off my own episodes because they're the only ones I've even got a chance of remembering properly.
That's all right.
So it's really bad of me, I don't know. But I wrote Blood and Water before the virtual season had properly come about. I remember that being something. So... I remember that being an episode that I was quite proud of. But definitely the first episode, Genesis, you need to read that one to have any hope of understanding the rest of it. The one that I always think about and I'm proudest of is the First Prophet. Mainly because I think the concept behind that is probably the best concept that I came up with. Because for anyone who's not read it, which is probably a lot of people, it's about generally, in general, it's about the idea of, I thought, well, if people like Frank Black exist and they're kind of psychic people, if you like, when did that come about? When did people start becoming psychic? And I suddenly thought, well, there must have been maybe like psychic cavemen, which sounds like really silly on the face of it. You think, well, maybe there was like cavemen or Neanderthals who are psychic as well. And how would they have dealt with that? And then I suddenly just collected the dots in my own imagination, thinking, well, maybe cave paintings that you see, they always draw real life on these cave paintings, don't they? They draw like animals and things and people. And I thought, well, maybe if you were a psychic caveman, you'd have drawn your visions. So you'd have really struggled with what you were seeing to interpret what you were seeing. Because if it was visions of the future, that would have been like very difficult, wouldn't it, for a caveman to even comprehend what they were seeing. So I certainly just these kind of dominoes started to happen in my head, thinking, well, yeah, you could have an adventure, couldn't you, involving like a discovered cave, and it had these cave paintings that had been done by a psychic human being, but from like 13,000 years ago, doing his best to interpret what he was seeing. And he was basically like a kind of Nostradamus, if you like, of his day. So it's kind of like a Nostradamus kind of a story, but with cave paintings and stuff. And even now, I think it sounds really silly when I'm talking about it out loud, but I do think it's a decent enough idea, and you could apply it to like a not just a Millennium. You could definitely take that idea and put it into different contexts and things, and have it as the basis of something else, like a National Treasure kind of a film, maybe, or something like that. So that episode was all kind of done in the spirit of kind of Indiana Jones and that kind of thing, and touching on some of the mythology of Millennium. But that idea, I always thought, I was really excited to write that episode, because if I only had one episode to write and somebody came to me and said, okay, we're doing a virtual season, you've only got one episode, that's probably the one I would have written. And that's the one I thought, yeah, I'm kind of like, I'm glad I got that one out. To think about it, it is quite integral to the virtual season, because it has a few characters in there that come back later on. As we have like the kind of enigmatic Frenchman in there, Alexander Lasso, who comes back in the finale and things. So there's definitely, yeah, so it's definitely an important one. And there's some stuff going on with Jordan as well to develop her powers. So that's quite an important one. So, and there's also a favourite of mine that I wrote. And so I'd probably say that one, if you had to choose one.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with a bit of self-promotion, Dan.
That's all I've done, isn't it?
No, it's good stuff. I think that's a great episode as well. I mean, I haven't read them all for this, I'll be honest, but I did read them not so long back, actually. Like, it was a few years ago, but I really do remember. I think I really liked The Dawn of Nothing as well, which I think you co-write, which was really sort of dark, all about snuff, pornography and things like that. That was a really dark example of Millennium. And, you know, and the mythological episodes like Rapture and Tribulation that you did, and, you know, were great as well. And Gestalt, which was all about Millennium Group and Congress and politics and things like that. So there's a real range in this season of episodes that absolutely could have fitted in Millennium. And I think avoids season three's awkward sort of blend for all the reasons that Kurt particularly has talked about with lots of people this season in brilliant ways about the real mishmash of ideas and showrunners and things that sort of make that season a bit of a jumble. But I think this has far more cohesion to it as a season of storytelling, which is great. And I think you don't have to read VS5 after this, to be fair. Like, I would encourage it, obviously, because, you know, it was one I was involved with. But it very much... And this is an ending, you know. This can work as an ending for Millennium. And I would encourage anyone, if they do feel like Goodbye to All That wasn't quite enough, if you haven't read this season, I would. Because I think you'd get a real satisfaction from it as a reader. So,
yeah, I'm interested to read the VS5 the more you talk about it. Because I've never read it, well, unfortunately. So just to see what you did, if you did indeed sort of continue what some of our things, I'd be interested to sort of see how you did that.
I think we tried, we considered it canon, 100%. We absolutely considered this canon. But we tried not to go too deep into continuing lots and lots of different things. We sort of started again in a way. But we do consider it canon, yeah. So I would be interested, if you do ever get around to reading it, I would be interested to see what you think, absolutely. And I would like to go into a bit more depth on that on this podcast at some point, but... we'll see. I'll see if I can smoke out my TV writer partner in crime from somewhere and see what happens. But Dan, this has been a fantastic chat, and I hope people listening will go and check out Virtual Season 4, which, as I say, just to repeat, is available at the Millennial Abyss, which you probably all know about. But if you don't, look up fourthhorsemanpress.com. You will find a link to this show there. And I would encourage anyone to go and read it. But hopefully, either way, you've got some interesting backstory of how it all came to be and some great nuggets of information from Dan. So, yeah, really appreciate you coming on to chat and go through your memory palace for this one, Dan.
Yeah, thank you. That's been great to talk about it.
Why don't you tell us then where people can find you online and what you're up to these days, you know, 20-something years on.
Oh, right, yeah. yeah, well, I still write, but mainly reviews and features and things for TV and film. So I run the website FrameRated, so it's framerated.co.uk. So you can check out some of my writing there, but I kind of edit that website, so it's kind of my thing. Also my own personal blog nowadays on Medium, so it's dansmediadigest.co.uk. There's a few things on there, but it's mainly Frame Rated, and I'm on Twitter as well, at danowen79, so you can follow me on Twitter, that'd be great.
Please do, guys. It's some great stuff from Dan and that he does, so yeah, check him out. And we'll be back for we've got a couple of episodes left of Millennium coverage of The Time Is Now. We're gonna talk to you a bit about what we're gonna do next, actually, because we put a call out on the Yellow House, which is our group on Facebook, and you unanimously said, everybody, that you wanted the podcast to carry on even after Millennium. So we're gonna give the people what they want, and we're gonna carry on, and we've got some ideas about what we're gonna do. So Kurt and I will be back to talk to you about that. And I've got one other episode that we're going to do, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the comics and about the Frank Black in comic form, which does link to the X-Files as well. So that's coming soon. So yeah, keep listening, guys. And thanks for joining us for another episode. Remember, we're part of the We Made This podcast network. And Millennium is not all we're discussing, so we'll give you a taste of what you might have missed on the network in a second. But until next time, as always, this is who we are.
Elsewhere... and We Made This. Cerebral Jukebox.
Yeah, I suppose there's something quite freeing about not knowing the words. So even if they're super dark, you just don't know. So you can, like... because you know you can get, like, a lot of songs which have a really cheerful musical undertone, but yeah, the actual meaning is quite nasty. and you're like, oof, this song is a bit much, really. But I suppose with songs that you don't know the actual meanings of, it's just sort of remains it with its like innocent musical intention. I mean, obviously Feliz Navidad is going to be a happy song. It's a Christmas song.
Right in the childhood.
So Fraser, have you heard of Round the Twist?
I have not, and the only reason I've done that Australian accent is because I think you mentioned it last time that it was an Australian show.
I did.
So that's all I've got.
So it's an Australian show from the early 90s.
It's not like Home and Away or Neighbours.
I mean, it has the same accents.
Oh, if we can say the same actors.
There might be, I don't remember.
They just do the same three shows over
Wouldn't
and over
it be
again.
Funny if Harold Bishop turned up?
I was going to say like Chris Hemsworth or like one of them.
Was Chris Hemsworth in Neighbours?
Yeah.
Was he?
I think Margot Robbie was as well.
Really? Kylie Minogue?
Yeah.
But the thing is, it will be Kylie Minogue era. So it'll be Kylie Minogue, Jason Donovan, Stephen Dennis, Craig McLaughlin, all of these.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast.
To watch Millennium. And again, this is
just to stress this, by the way. I was 18 at the time, so I'm just going to say that. Yeah, okay.
I know, and were you a Kiss fan, Kurt?
I was a rock fan. I don't think I was a Kiss fan, no.
Yeah, because this is exactly the situation that you're in, where you're talking about like middle-aged men in suits in Hollywood who are trying to project what kids want from their entertainment and what will bring them in. It's the same logic that got you, for example, Coolio in the episode Oran-Or of Space Above and Beyond, which is Fox desperately reaching into the darkness and trying to find something that would make kids watch it. Because it's worth noting that Kiss were, I believe, in the middle of something close to a Kissonnaissance, is that what we'll call it?
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, and X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.